If minds are essentially blank slates, carved into what they become by their environment, then the only thing limiting our ability as a society to turn anyone into anything at all is the skill of our teachers. Teachers who make up the greater part of the mind-shaping period of childhood are the ones who deserve the most praise when people succeed, and are the ones who deserve the most scorn when people fail. There's a saying often placed on motivational posters in the field of education: teachers plant the seeds of knowledge that last a lifetime. But what if people themselves are already more like seeds than soil? Soil is an empty receptacle that will generally grow whatever you can plant in it. If a gardener chooses to plant acorn seeds instead of apricot seeds, then in virtue of that action, he is responsible for the fact that his garden grew acorn trees instead of apricots. On the other hand, the seed depends on certain elements in its environment in order to grow properly, but it already comes with its own built-in blueprint, which essentially lays down the plan for what it is going to become, even when it is still nothing but a small kernel indistinguishable from any other. The gardener deserves credit for watering his plants and ensuring the health of his soil, sure, but once he started dealing with an acorn seed, he was not responsible for the fact that that acorn seed became an oak tree in particular. The acorn seed unfolds according to its own internal blueprint into an acorn tree, because that is what it is. And while the environment it is planted in can stunt its capacity to fully unfold that internal blueprint, the blueprint comes from within, not from without. So are children like soil, passively waiting to grow whatever type of seed the gardeners of education choose to plant within them? Or are they themselves more like seeds, unfolding into what they will become according to their own blueprints, depending on their environment, only to create the preconditions to allow this process to take place? If we assume that people are like soil, then we will take the fact that one group excels over another group as evidence that the first group is getting too much, and the second group is getting too little of our resources and attention. We'll want to increase our focus on the second group by reducing it from the first until it achieves comparable outcomes. If people are blank slates, then their unequal outcomes must axiomatically be the result of the fact that we have treated them unequally, and therefore treated them unfairly. But if children are more like seeds than soil, then this will all be wasted effort. Pouring more water on a crepe myrtle or planting it in better soil will never make it grow as tall as a redwood. The blueprint simply does not contain those plants. If you try to make that happen, you'll waste incredible amounts of time and resources that could have achieved something far more productive if used some other way. So when it comes right down to it, you simply have to accept crepe myrtle seeds and redwood seeds for what they are. You'll never create a world's tallest trees exhibit by planting crepe myrtles, but you wouldn't want to plant redwoods in your front yard. The key is to first accept them for what they are, so you can find places where their inherent traits fit in appropriately. There's another important upshot of this distinction between seeds and soil. Suppose we had a variety of seeds and we didn't know what they were, and we needed to create the tallest row of trees possible. They've only been tested in very bad soil so far, so they're all withering, and it's impossible to tell if any would naturally grow to be taller than any of the others if placed in better soil. In this scenario, what would we do? As we found out which seeds responded to being watered and placed in good soil by growing taller than the others, we would then want to devote even more of our time and resources to those trees, and even less to those that still seem to come up short once placed in better soil. We have limited time and resources on hand to produce the outcomes we need to achieve, and that time and resources will produce far more dividends invested in the better seeds than it will continually invested in those that lag behind. The application to people is obvious. If people are more like seeds than soil, then failing to devote more resources to the most gifted children is a far greater sin than failing to devote more resources to those who lag behind. The most gifted are like redwoods. In a proper environment, they'll grow to become some of the tallest trees on earth. By impoverishing their environment, you can stunt their development and make it seem as though the difference between redwoods and crepe myrtles isn't as large as it really is. But the redwood doesn't owe the fact that it is a redwood to its environment. A crepe myrtle planted in the same soil will never grow as tall. And the gap can be reduced far more easily by stunting the redwood than it can by raising the height of the crepe myrtle. If we neglect the most intelligent children in a vain attempt to catch slower children up, we aren't just wasting time. We're stunting the growth of those redwoods while trying in vain to make the crabapples grow equally tall. In fact, some educational systems already incorporate this kind of understanding. Germany, for example, tracks children into different types of schools based on teachers' and parents' assessment of their potential. And this begins as early as fifth grade. So what has this produced for Germany? An unemployment rate that is half of the United States, for one. For another, a world-renowned reputation for high-quality products like the BMW, created by its blue-collar workforce. Students of low to average intellectual ability are aimed towards apprenticeships rather than universities. So rather than attempting to turn crabapples into redwoods, the German system aims to plant crabapples in the most appropriate place to put crabapples, and then tries to make them into the best crabapples they can be. In the end, this works out to the best interests of everyone, from the workers themselves to the national economy of Germany as a whole. Yet, left-wing critics, including Werner Munoz, whose UN report on the right to education gave Germany low marks, describe the German system as an anachronism, a refuge for the privileged, which emphasizes social inequality. Sure, clearly Germany should become more like the United States, where spending on K-12 education, even once adjusted for inflation, has roughly tripled over the last four decades, and yet scores on reading, math, and science tests have remained perfectly flat across that period of time. While most Americans polled in 2007 expressed the belief that the biggest problem with public schooling is insufficient funding, the last four decades have in fact been a national experiment in rampantly increased educational spending. And the results of that experiment have been clear. As a society, none of us, including our children, have benefited from this massive influx of resources into education. How could that be? The proponent of the people as seeds perspective can easily explain this discrepancy. Placing crabapples in better soil won't turn them into redwoods. Redwood seeds become redwood trees because they're redwoods, not because of the type of soil they're planted into. But the proponent of the people as soil perspective has a serious problem. How could we add this much fertilizer into the soil and see literally no increase in the height of our trees? Thankfully, science has reached a stage where it can in fact answer this question of whether people are seeds or soil once and for all. And the evidence is clear. People are not soil as much as they are seeds. To explain what the science says about this, I'll give a rundown of a few basic concepts. First, heritability. This is the concept that all of the studies we usually perform to try to estimate how genetic a behavior is are going to be measuring. Strictly speaking, how heritable something is and how genetic it is are not the same thing. The distinction is that heritability measurements do not measure the total influence that an individual's genes have on that individual's behavior. As we'll see in a moment, heritability estimates can both overestimate and underestimate how genetic something is in this everyday common sense. So what these studies can do is take for granted the amount of currently seen variation in behavior or personality traits between individuals in a given population, and then estimate how much of that variation is the result of variation between those individuals' genes or environments. So, without any change in how genetic a behavior or personality trait is, the heritability of that trait can change. This is because heritability is a relative, not an absolute value. So if we study the heritability of height by looking at the United States in 2017, we're going to find a very high value. It is mostly genes that determine who is taller than who in the United States in 2017. But this is because very few people are being exposed to the environmental influences that can influence how tall people grow to be as adults. For instance, very few people in the United States in 2017 experienced the kind of severe caloric deprivation it takes to stunt their physical growth. if half the United States were to experience an economic crash in 2018 and this kind of severe caloric deprivation appeared again, what would happen when we re-measured the heritability of height that year? The heritability would fall significantly, because now an environmental factor would explain a much larger proportion of the differences in height found within the United States between the half where severe caloric deprivation is prevalent and the half where it is not. On the other hand, heritability estimates can also underestimate the total degree to which a trait is genetic as well. We know, for example, that there are a small minority of people who can spend years smoking cigarettes and still have perfectly healthy lungs. We know that this is due to the protective effect of a few unique genes which studies have now specifically identified. If we studied the heritability of lung cancer now, environmental exposure to cigarette smoke through smoking would be the most significant predictor of someone developing lung cancer, so we would find an extremely low value for the heritability of lung cancer. But what if this situation were to change? What if the good genes to protect against the damage from smoking were to spread throughout a large percentage of the population and smoking as a habit became widespread again? Suddenly, the heritability of lung cancer in America would become extremely high, because now that almost everyone is exposed to cigarette smoke in their environment, looking at who is being exposed to cigarette smoke would be a less effective way of predicting who would develop lung cancer than looking at who has the protective genes. With almost everyone being exposed to cigarette smoke, knowing someone had been exposed just wouldn't give you very solid grounds for predicting how anything would turn out in the future. In short, heritability is as close as we can get to trying to estimate how genetic a trait or a behavior is. While it doesn't tell us how responsible an individual's genes are for that individual's traits or behaviors, it can tell us how responsible genes are for the differences found within groups of people in a large population. So how do the studies accomplish that? Traditional heritability studies primarily take two techniques. The first technique is to hold the environment constant in order to see how much variation between the individuals in that segment remain. What remains will have to be the amount of variation due to genetics. The second technique is to hold genes constant in order to see how much variation between individuals remains, since the amount that remains must be due to the environment. You can achieve the former technique by comparing adopted and biological children raised in the same home from a young age. You can achieve the latter technique by looking at identical twins who were raised apart. Of course, this is not exhaustive. There are many other techniques you can employ, such as comparing the amount of similarity found between identical and non-identical twins and then calculating this against the proportion of genes shared by identical and non-identical twins, but for the purpose of this article, I'm going to focus on the more straightforward methods. Without exception, the results of all of these studies show that human personality and intellectual ability is very heritable. In other words, when people in the modern world differ in IQ or personality traits, that difference is usually owed to differences in genes more than it is to differences in the environment. So what this means in very concrete terms is that adopted children grow up to be more like their biological parents they've never met than they are like the siblings they grew up next to or the parents they were raised by. Yet, at the same time, identical twins grow up to be significantly more like each other than non-twin siblings do. And this happens even if their childhoods never intersect because they grew up in completely different homes. By the lowest estimates made by nearly anyone, anywhere, in any respectable academic position, the heritability of IQ is at least around 50%. The remaining scientific debate is not over whether IQ is heritable. There is literally no respectable scientific theory which supposes that IQ is mostly determined by the environment. The debate is between people called environmentalists and people called hereditarians, but even those so-called environmentalists would be hereditarians in many everyday common people's terms. They take the position that IQ is somewhere around 50% heritable. That's the left side of the scientific debate. On the right side, the hereditarians who take a stronger stance simply raise that estimate up from 50% to 80%. To get a more tangible idea of what these values mean, let's plug some overly simplified numbers into a hypothetical scenario. Suppose that in the population we're studying, the range in IQ stretches from scores of exactly 80 at the low end to exactly 120 at the top. If IQ were 50% heritable in this population, then people would be born with genes that set their IQ somewhere between 90 and 110. Then, the most extremely good or extremely bad environments that any part of this population is ever exposed to would be capable of adding or taking away another 10 points to produce that person's IQ. To quickly explain these numbers, the total range in IQ in this population, from 80 to 120, is 40 points. If genes are responsible for half of that, that means genes would be responsible for 20 total IQ points. Thus, we would start in the middle at 100. Genes would first add or take away up to 10 total points in either direction, and then the environment would add or take away up to 10 more points. Thus, someone born with the worst genes for IQ seen in this population would start at 90 IQ. They could reach an IQ as high as 100 with the help of the most beneficial environmental boost possible. And being placed in the most corrosive environment seen anywhere in this population could cause their IQ to fall as low as 80. Meanwhile, someone born with the best genes for IQ seen in this population could only reach an IQ of 100 by being exposed to the worst environment ever seen in this population. And he will never, under any circumstances, perform worse on IQ tests than the individual with the worst genes for IQ. It would take exposure to the worst environment possible just to make him do equally as poorly as the individual with the worst genes can do only with the help of the best environment possible. Now, if you can, try to let it sink in that this is what the environmentalists in the modern scientific debate over the heritability of IQ believe is true. Even in this scenario, as you can see, genes are still extremely significant for explaining the differences between individuals. On the other hand, if the hereditarians were correct about this population and its IQ were found to be 80% heritable, then a person would be born with genes to place their IQ somewhere between 84 and 116. And the best and worst environments could add or take away at most only 4 points to produce that individual's IQ. Again, to quickly explain these numbers, the total range and variation between an IQ of 80 and an IQ of 120 is still 40 points. If genes are responsible for 80% of that variation, then they are responsible for 32 total points. Thus, starting in the middle at 100, we divide this in half and move either direction, so a gene start them off with an up to an extra 16 points, either for or against them, and then the environment fills in the remaining 20% of that variation by adding or taking away up to 4 points. This might not be genetic determinism, but damn if it isn't close. One important point that gets missed in many entry-level discussions of this topic is that the heritability of IQ changes across different age groups. In children, the heritability of IQ is pretty low. In late teens and younger and older adults, the heritability of IQ rises substantially. Environmentalist arguments have often tried to draw power from studies that solely looked at the heritability of IQ in children. And one study we'll look at in the next entry to this series, the environmental influence over the IQ of children adopted into the homes of parents of a different race was large, and the heritability was low. Case closed, the environmentalist wanted to shout, except that when a follow-up was performed 10 years later, that environmental influence had almost totally washed out. The IQ of those children's biological parents was then, once again, the most significant predictor of their current IQ, not the IQs of the adopted parents who raised them, or the siblings they grew up beside. The best way to think about this discrepancy is to imagine that children come with blueprints handed down to them by their parents, which lay out the plan for what their adult IQ is going to be. However, the speed at which children are exposed to different environmental stimuli will have a significant impact on how fast they put that blueprint together. So can we infer from the general heritability of IQ to the heritability of IQ differences between the races? Technically, no. That is, again, because heritability is a relative value. We have to establish that the environment that two individuals are exposed to is the same before we can estimate the amount of variation left over that may be due to genetics. since the left-wing argument is that members of different racial groups are exposed to systematically different environments because of their race, it would beg the question to just assume that what goes for the heritability of IQ between two white individuals must also go for the heritability of IQ between a white individual and a black one. Hypothetically, it could be that systemic racism is real, and once we control for the effects of it, the heritability of IQ differences between the races falls, but still doesn't disappear completely, because some but not all of those gaps were due to heredity. In any case, that is why an important part of this debate will always belong to sociology, a topic I've taken a reasonable start on addressing in many of my previous articles. So it does take extra work to figure out the cause of the differences between two different groups, even once you know the causes of the differences between the different individuals within those different groups. We'll take a look in the next entry to see how far the science is capable of taking us on that question.